Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 21. On this week's show, we return to our Disney Movie Hour as we take a look back at 1941's The Reluctant Dragon. To my left, as always, is Brian. Say hello, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
Across from me is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. Pogo. I used that on a much earlier episode, episode number 4, actually, I think it was, but always a good thing to bring around again. There we go. Words. You can find his videos over at youtube.com/Pogo. You can find more of his music at soundcloud.com/Pogo Mix, and his home web address is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod, P-O-D. And on Facebook, if you want to put in our little Disney Magic Hour and do a search for that, you can find our group on there where we do some previews of shows that are upcoming and we talk about news of the week and whatnot, because we don't normally cover that too much on the show itself because, meh, yeah.
Because it's covered everywhere.
Yeah, you read it 100 places. And then head on over to iTunes. And if you could, search for us, hit subscribe, hit a 5-star review. Maybe you've already done that because you're listening. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you've only done one half of it. Do the other half. Yep. Got it. Good. How's everybody?
Good.
Good.
All right. Nothing like the best backup in the world. All right, guys. Let's move on. Actually, you might notice we are only 3 this week, as I think we were in the previous show that we did. And that is because Scott is getting married in 2 days. So he's kind of busy. Or upstairs. I really actually don't know.
He's picking up something from the airport, isn't he? Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, he's actually getting married in just a couple of days. So early congratulations to him, and we're looking forward to the future. Fun.
The future.
Just the future in general.
Just the future.
So, okay, we've had a way of doing these films so far with Snow White and Pinocchio and Fantasia. And now we've come across a film where first we questioned whether or not we should cover this one because it doesn't really have any impact on the parks. It doesn't – it's a half animated, you know, half live action. So it I don't really think it met all the criteria, but we also thought it was kind of a fascinating entry into the mix. And that is 1941's The Reluctant Dragon, which – you can't buy separately on disc or anything, can you?
Not that I saw. Not when I was looking stuff up. I didn't see anything about that.
So actually, how did you watch it, Brian?
I watched it on Netflix, but then I also realized that I had taped it on my DVR from
Turner Classic.
From Turner Classic, yeah, because I was flipping through and it was with all my Disney stuff. I was like, oh, but I watched it on Netflix.
That was how me and Melissa watched it.
Yeah, because we had it recorded from way back, I think in July. Or so.
Yeah, it wasn't the previous night. It was the one previous to that.
Yeah.
I think when they also did like Darby O'Gill and whatnot, I think it was that night.
Yeah.
When they showed all that. I do actually own it on DVD. It's part of one of the Walt Disney collector tins that I have. I couldn't tell you which one it is, though. I draw a blank. I can't remember which one it is.
I had it written down. I don't remember. I want to say Treasures, but I could be wrong.
Well, that's the name of the whole collection. They're all called Walt Disney Treasures. Well,
that's why I would think that.
Yeah.
The one that
you're not wrong.
The one that you guys watched was the whole movie, not just the short.
No, we watched the whole thing. The whole movie. Yeah, we watched the whole movie. So let's talk about why did this movie come about? That's one of the more fascinating things is this isn't a traditional release. It isn't a plot. It's more of a documentary. It's kind of a commercial for the studio, and it just gives you a glimpse of a couple of unreleased shorts that they work into the quote-unquote plot of this film as our narrator slash guide, Robert Benchley, whom, for just a little bit of trivia, that is the grandfather of Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws. So he's very important to me. So, I don't know, Melissa, where did this come about?
What do you mean? Like for the time period itself?
I don't know what that question actually means in reverse. why did the Reluctant Dragon become something that the studio thought was a viable option for a theatrical release?
That's a good question, Pete.
All right, I'll answer it then.
Well, I'm
had your phone
say,
out and everything.
Well,
I thought you had things.
I have the phone out because I was finding it's called, it's on the Walt Disney Treasures behind the scenes at Disney Studios. So that's
okay.
The whole thing that I was thinking of is like this kind of reminded me of like a behind the scenes type, you know, thing, kind of documentary-ish.
Yeah.
And well, during the time period was when the whole staff strike was going on
when it was released.
Yeah So like the development of it was kind of leading up to that period. Workers might not have been too happy.
Yeah, maybe people wouldn't have went along with some of the large group filming scenes
just, yeah,
you know, a couple of months later or something. Yeah. Like that. Yeah. But yeah, this was used as a stopgap though because of the war.
Yeah, that was the main reason.
And
it,
you know, they were
about
having trouble, they were having financial trouble, and they were trying to get stuff out there, and Walt, you know, discovered and then used much later, you know, in the, well, not much later, but during this time, live action is quicker to make.
Yeah.
I can put out a lot more live action films than I can animated films.
Yeah. And I think maybe this was kind of a behind the scenes look for people because they were having trouble money wise and stuff, that maybe people could, some people would see how the, you know, the process that was made and stuff like that. And that could, you know, bring in different investors or something like that. That, you know, that's a possibility.
And this was when he just built the new studio.
Yeah, this was after the new studios were built.
So it was kind of like a, hey, look what we got now.
Look at all our fancy stuff.
Yeah. Got bills to pay with this stuff.
Yep.
Because actually, you know, the True Life Adventures, which was another, you know, hey, we can do these and these are really great and they're not overly expensive and we can make a lot of them. That didn't start till 1948. So this is still, you know, very early in the process of trying to figure out, what is this studio? Is it, you know, because it can't just be animation, because then we're only going to release one film every 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work. Yeah. So we have to find other avenues. And that was one of them. And also, yeah, maybe this was kind of a PR thing.
Yeah.
From a, you know, from a standpoint of, I know that, you know, in the PBS documentary, they kind of speak of Walt being not very well keyed into the oncoming tidal wave of the strike and all that. But maybe others were. Maybe other people were like, hey, you know what? This might be a good thing to put out there just to kind of have a goodwill message going on and about.
Yeah, and everybody in it is very happy-go-lucky, you know.
It's a very, you know, a Disney magic documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really what it is.
Is this the first live action that they did in a movie? Is it
first live action or first live action and animation?
And animation mixed together.
I mean, just in like my list of like feature films, this is the first, right?
Yeah,
like cross.
So yeah, so that's a, you know, that's kind of a big moment, but it's such a strange thing to watch. So I mean, we start off in black and white, actually.
Yep.
And we start with Robert Benchley at home, playing himself, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he's playing himself, and his wife.
Yeah, it's just him and his wife. And they're in the pool, and he gets an idea for a movie. He's basically reading The Reluctant Dragon, or she's reading it to him.
Yeah, she's reading it to him.
That's right, yes.
And it kind of opened up like she was reading the story to a child, but it was him in the pool. But he was acting kind of
exactly
like a child.
Like a child,
with his hot gun and stuff.
And then she says, you should, you know, pitch this to Walt Disney, just like, you know, because that's all it is, just as simple as that. We can just do that. And he gets kind of strong-armed by his wife into, okay, I'll go down to the Disney studios tell them who I am, and just meet with Walt, because that's how it works.
Yep, 100%.
Now, in the movie, ultimately, spoiler, it does work. And I really am curious if that was even a possibility in the early days of the studio, because it wasn't open. It was kind of an open door. Maybe not when the main campus was open and the huge campus was open, mm-hmm. but just previous to that.
I mean, they kind of even tell you the nature of Hollywood in the PBS special on Walt Howe. When Walt first went out to LA, he wandered around the Universal set. So I do kind of feel like it was a little bit more free back then. I don't know if the Disney Studios in particular was that free, mm-hmm. but I do feel like Hollywood itself was a little bit more, you know, relaxed in who could approach the studios.
Yeah. It wasn't like he was not a well-known or not like a known person.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he was.
It wasn't just a Joe Schmo walking up to the studio.
They play him down, actually, in the film. Yeah. He was a very well-known satirist.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So
I didn't know who you were talking about for a minute. I thought you were talking about Disney.
No, eventually, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, so they actually have to play down his celebrity a little bit in the film.
Yeah.
So he seems a little more like, aw, shucks.
Yeah.
You know, to a lot of things. So you know what I really liked? They had a play on the storybook opening that we've had in other films. You know, with the classic fairy tale book opening?
Do
that with this.
Yeah.
Which was funny, and we just watched something that did that
so
also.
So Dear to My Heart?
Yeah, So Dear to My Heart did that as well. It had this, yes, it was, because it was up in the attic.
Yeah, it was the scrapbook. Book was in the attic.
That's a movie we will get to eventually, So Dear to My Heart. That's not till the mid-60s, though. No, So Dear to My Heart was the 40s. Summer Magic was in the 60s. Yeah. This all came up recently on another thing, so you guys will hear a little more of that. So now we kind of segue over to the Disney Studios, where Whistle While You Work is playing as the music in the background. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I noted that.
And something I thought from the documentaries that I've seen of what the Pixar campus is like now, that is kind of what they're going for in the introduction of the Walt Disney Studios. Mm-hmm. Again, it's usually documentaries, behind the scenes look at the Pixar campus. It could be that everyone's acting for the camera. I don't think that, though. I think that people genuinely enjoy working there. So I thought it was interesting how something, you know, from way back in the past, almost what, 70 years now, over 70 years.
Yeah.
Is very mirror-like to the current situation in what you would say is, you know, one of the largest portions of the Disney company, and that is Pixar. So, I don't know. Do you guys catch anything else specific about him coming up there and whatnot?
Just in his approach to the studio?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I was more, you know, once he got into the studio, that's when you kind of hit all like the little nuggets of like, oh, I know that, or I've seen that. Yeah. I did think it was interesting where the young kid that was kind of like assigned to him to bring him to Walt's office was giving him like a mini tour. And I jotted down, it's like the first like cast member to be like, this is what we have here.
Yeah. And then, so he does get in, and he gets into the art class, right? That's one of the first places?
Yeah, that's the first one.
The first place, yeah.
So he gets through security. To his surprise, he actually starts walking away because he thinks that everyone's just going to say, no, thank you. You can leave now, sir.
Yeah.
But he actually gets the okay. Oh, yeah, sure. Here's a visitor's pass. Go find Walt. Okay. Yeah, great. So he goes into the building, and as you said, he has a guide. Do you remember his name?
Humphrey.
Okay. So he's got a guide, Humphrey, and he ditches him immediately.
Of course.
And he winds up over. Oh, you know what? I put down Humphrey is basically our Boy Scout.
Yeah.
He is a Disney Boy Scout.
Yeah.
And we go into an art class, which is being held, and they're drawing Dumbo. They're actually working on sketching of Dumbos in the background and whatnot.
Well, they're sketching an elephant.
Yeah, they're sketching an elephant. You know, they play it up like it's going to be a model. You know,
a nude model.
Yeah, a nude model. And it is. It's an elephant, though. But there's also Bambi sketches in the background.
Yeah, I noted there was Bambi sketches. There was Bambi and Thumper. There was also the Fantasia centaurs I saw in the background.
Okay.
Also, when he's over there, like before he kind of is noticed in the class and he's kind of sneaking around, there was a Pinocchio marionette kind of hanging up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was really cool.
He really makes a lot of trouble, like immediately. Yeah. He comes in and smashes everything.
Yeah.
Very klutzy.
It's very, like the elephant. No, but he does. Yeah, he takes out like half the room, and the guy comes walking over to him like, "Oh, it's okay."
Yeah, I know.
It's fine.
Immediately, you'd be like thrown off the lot.
Yeah,
like who are you? He then goes into the orchestra one. This was one of my favorite little pieces of the Reluctant Dragon, because we get a look into the process that was used. Granted, like 4 years ago, but in a 1937 animated short, Mickey's Amateurs, which focused on Clara Cluck and Donald Duck as they perform an opera, in a sense.
Yeah.
And Florence Gill is doing the voice of Clara Cluck, and you have Clarence Clash doing the voice of Donald Duck. And I really loved it because just the idea, you know, he tries to describe how he does Donald's voice. He's like, just make a pocket of air in the side of your mouth. I'm like, I don't even know what he means.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really, really cool. And, you know, showing the process of finding a character's voice, an animated character's voice, which to me is kind of fascinating. Now, Brian, I know Donald's your favorite character.
Yeah.
So did you dig, I mean, I'm assuming you dug this?
No, I loved it. That was probably my second favorite. The section that comes after that was my favorite. Of the, like, I guess, like the studio backlot tour that they do here. But yeah, no, it's amazing to just, I always find voice acting like that, that type of voice acting fascinating. And just to see them doing it and hear that voice coming out of them is just really cool. And it was just awesome to see.
Yeah.
And like you said, make a pocket of air, like, In your cheek.
Yeah. I gotta say, though, Benchley does a
good job.
Really good Donald Duck.
Yeah. Do you think he was doing it, or do you think it was, like, voiced over?
I have a feeling he was doing it.
Okay. Because I was wondering. I was like,
You know, I actually think he was pulling that off. And then, I hope he was, because it was a good one.
And then, after they're done, they're talking to him. They start talking to him in the voices of...
Yeah, like they keep the character.
They keep the character and they first start talking to him.
Yeah, I really like Clara Cluck. She was really funny. That made me genuinely laugh out loud as soon as she started singing, quote unquote.
Yeah.
I thought that was fun. But now, Brian, you were saying the next one is your favorite?
Yeah, the Foley session that they go to. Okay. I really enjoyed that one. Just to see how they put all the sounds together with the picture and just the different methods they use to get all these different sounds that you wouldn't, you know, you might not even think of, or just watching it all sync up together was just a really cool thing. I'm always interested in, like, the background and stuff. That's why I really actually did enjoy this, because I like seeing how things are made.
Yeah. I love, like, the whole process of making sounds, like, the way they used to do. Like, I don't know what they do now. I'm sure there's so many recordings.
They still do, because I remember watching something for The Walking Dead.
Oh, yeah?
When it, like, the first or second season, and they did basically a lot of the same type of stuff that they're doing.
Yeah, no, they still create sounds. It's not made. Like, people will go out into the field and record sound.
Yeah that is, like, the coolest thing. So this was a really awesome
section.
Yeah,
I love the part with the train where Casey Jr. was starting up. And
Did you know who was voicing Casey Jr. in this?
No.
I'll give you her name. She's using a Sonovox also, actually, to create that effect. Her name is Frances Gifford. Take a wild guess who her husband is.
Frank?
Yeah, Frank Gifford.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I looked it up, because as soon as I saw her last name was Gifford, I was like, well, it's the right time frame, right?
Yeah,
error,
yeah,
and everything.
That is, yeah.
And looked it up, and wow. That's actually Frank Gifford's wife, Frances Gifford, who did a lot of acting in her day. She was in actually a couple of, like, Tarzan films and whatnot, and Thrill of Romance. She went to the races, The Glass Key. She was just in a ton of films. If I was to get an actual number, I wouldn't tell you, but we actually share the same birthday, December 7th.
Aww.
So, and according to this, she is still around.
Cool.
Yeah, she's still around. And Frank just passed recently.
Yeah, not that long ago.
Yeah, back in August of this year, he just passed away. So, I thought that was really, really cool. And then she becomes kind of our B to Benchley's A.
Yeah.
You know, she is the one who he reconnects with a number of times now throughout the film.
She's, pulls him through all the different scenes that come up.
Yeah, because next we get introduced to color.
Yeah, I liked this one.
This was really cool too.
Yeah, he was again trying to avoid Humphrey. He was trying to avoid him, and he stumbles into the room where they're using the camera, the multiplane camera, and he turns around, and it's done in such a great way where he turns around, and all of a sudden the book he's holding is bright yellow, and he's like, oh, Technicolor.
Yeah, and then they have the sequence of all the paints being combined and whatnot. I thought that was really, really cool.
It is, yeah.
And because we've been black and white up to this point, it obviously pops a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that was really great. And then Frances Gifford shows up again and basically says, Technicolor. You know, she introduces the, you know, furthers the introduction of the actual use of Technicolor.
Yeah.
So actually, and you know what? I'm wrong. The color sequence doesn't come up till the next one. With the paints.
Oh, with the paint department.
The paint being mixed up. That's the next one, because they then go to the ink and paint.
Yeah, and they show the. I thought when he stumbles into the room, I don't know. I have it written down when he stumbles into the room, it's changed to Technicolor.
No, it does.
No, that does.
Oh, okay.
The sequence I was talking about was the paint being mixed together.
Oh, yeah, that's after the camera.
Yeah, that's in the ink and paint section of the studio.
Where they sing.
Where they sing.
Hi-ho. Which I thought was another.
Oh, yeah, I got it right there. Yeah. Hi-ho playing as we see mixing of paints.
Yeah.
So this is actually where the mixing of paints occurs. And I really, really thought this was great. And this had a lot of little hidden things around, because there was a lot of maquettes that were sitting around. And in particular, you can find a Captain Hook who is actually in a black and white outfit.
Yeah, I did pick that up. Yeah.
So this was obviously before they had ever come to a decision. I mean, Peter Pan isn't until 1953 or 51. Like it's 53 or 51. So, you know, we're way ahead of when that's going to happen. We also have the Siamese cats from Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, and the woman holding them.
Yeah. We have Chernabog. We also have Zeus from Fantasia. Mm-hmm. We have Goofy and Swim Gear. Was another one that was in there. And they had a one-to-one replica of one of the clocks from Pinocchio.
Yeah, the cuckoo clock.
The drunk one, you know, when he's hiccuping. They actually have the maquette of the full size of that, which I thought was really, really cool. So this was, I really loved this section of the film. I was like, oh, wow, this is really, really cool.
Yeah, I did know there was Timothy the Mouse also, who's from Tumbo. And I did.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's who she puts up, right?
Oh,
at the very end, I think that's the one she.
Maybe I don't remember.
What do you mean she puts up?
Not that she puts up. That's
what word are you looking for?
No, you know what? I think it's in the next section.
Oh, okay.
When they have the clay models, that's where I'm thinking of.
No, that's in there. That's section? That's the maquettes.
Yeah, she has them. She he's like, is that Mickey Mouse?
Oh, okay.
I think that's who that was, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well, right, I definitely wrote it was Timothy the Mouse, so if that's what, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was the zebra centaur from Fantasia.
Which he steals.
Yeah.
Doesn't he, like, ultimately he steals that? Oh, yeah. And then that zebra centaur does not appear in Fantasia.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it does.
That's the one where, it's the two girls who are, like, riding with, the god, the drunk god. Why do I forget his name? Bacchus. Right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're like bringing him in.
Oh, all right, okay. All right, cool. So yeah, he actually does steal that,
he gives it to Walt at the end.
Which is ridiculous. Can't steal that. It's way too huge. So moving on from there, we get into a storyboard now. Now we're going into the area of the studio where they work on storyboards, and they do a very interesting work into showing you your first short. The animated short of the film, but you don't see a full animated version. You watch it as it was being pitched in the storyboard, and it's called Baby Weems. Yeah. Now, did you guys enjoy this short?
It was interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I thought it was pretty clever. I liked it.
Yeah, it was clever in the way they did it. It was interesting because it had a lot of references for things that were like in the time. You know, there were definitely some racist stuff.
Yeah, there were some things that weren't exactly grand.
Yeah.
What were we watching? In Summer Magic. The girl, one of the characters in the film, you don't see him till near the end. And he's in Japan. Or he's in China.
Yeah, I think he's
and
in China.
And she code names him the Yellow Peril.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Now, I don't know if she meant that towards the house because they call it the Yellow House.
Yeah.
But he was in Asia and she was calling him the Yellow Peril. And I was like, oh, all right then. Okay. Let's move along.
Yeah.
So, I enjoyed this one. I thought this was pretty cool. And also, I thought it was a great way of displaying how a storyboard can work.
Yeah. No, that's what I was going to say. I think I really enjoyed the way it was presented.
And this was something that, you know, this is how Walt did it. You know, this is how the company did it at that time. Actually, it's also how Hitchcock did his films. Hitchcock used to storyboard out entire sections of his film, if not the whole film, much in the style of this. So I really thought it was pretty cool. And there was a Dolly reference in there as well, which I thought was interesting because Walt and Dolly had been working on that section for Fantasia. And, you know, I thought it was cool to just see his name kind of brought up. And we also get to see Mount Rushmore in this, but it's not completed.
Yeah, it had like, what, two of the faces?
It only had Washington and Lincoln because it was not completed until October of 1941. I honestly had never really looked up a photo of the unfinished Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
And so I got to see it here, you know, which was kind of strange, but I really, really dug it.
Yeah.
So was there anything else that you guys noticed that happened in that short and whatnot? Or
no, just the one thing that stuck out to me was kind of what Melissa said, was when they were making the radio announcements.
Yeah.
They
were going around the world, yeah.
Very interesting when they went around the world.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't the most sensitive.
No. But yeah, it was...
It's a product of the time.
Oh, of course. I don't mean anything.
I don't mean to cancel it out or anything like that because it's wrong. But it's also good that they don't delete that.
Yeah, no, because at the time it wasn't. That's the way it was.
It's so good that they don't go and like take that out of the film now because I think it's important to just kind of have things presented as they were. You know, there's no reason to censor it, and then you know you can see it and go like, okay, that wouldn't fly today, good reason.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It was a little
and you know what I found interesting? Just going back to the last section before that, because I remember in the Walt documentary that they were talking about how, you know, it was mostly the men were the animators, but the women were working in the ink and the paint department.
Yeah.
And when they got there, it was all women.
Yeah, it was all women.
It was really, like, all women. And I was like, oh, I might not have noticed that, like, I really picked up on that unless I had heard it in the documentary.
Yeah, Ink and Paint Girl is very, very specific because that's all they were.
And that's what Lillian Disney was, right?
She started out as Ink and Paint Girl.
The previous place to Disney Studios?
I can't remember. Hyperion? No. Are you referring to when they were at Hyperion?
Before they became the...
Yeah,
before...
Their first.
Like when he first met her. Because in One Man's Dream, in the movie at the end, you know, they're like...
Yeah.
She says he married his ink and paint girl, Lillian.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly when they met. I gotta be honest. I have a gray cloud on the on when they met. I don't have that info in my brain.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say we kind of skipped over the multi-plane camera a little bit because they showed you how it worked. He had to like climb a huge ladder to get up on top there, and he made, you know, a big deal about being afraid of heights or whatever. But I think this is also, Brian, where you were talking about, because this is where like Donald Duck comes in, and he's like walking through the, what was it, like a field almost or a farm?
Yeah, it was a field, I think.
Yeah, and they kind of show you how he moves, right?
Yeah, he's talking to a woman like, you know, my foot's up here, and then it's down there.
Yeah, so they were showing you like why they put the cells in and out, and like then they do it really fast.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I'm sorry. I totally forgot about that. And that was way back in the color introduction.
Yeah.
Right? When we get the introduction of Technicolor and whatnot.
Yeah, when he first gets into that room. Because then, it's a huge room with the huge, you know, ladder for all the different planes of the camera to look through and stuff, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, because you know what? It's something to hear how they do it. Because we were talking about, you were talking about that when we were talking Snow White and stuff. That technique. And you hear it, and you kind of, you know, until you actually see how what it looks like, you don't really, I don't know if you can.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand as much until I saw it.
Yeah, no, it's a big piece of equipment. You know? It's not just,
yeah, it was
you
not
know.
As big as that. I thought it was big, but not like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the one they have in One Man's Dream, I think, is only like three or four planes or something. So I wasn't like something in like my that. Head yeah. thinking like I have to climb a ladder to get there. Like, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And now you understand that during the sequence of Fantasia,
yeah.
why a little tremor of an earthquake would throw off an entire ship. Shot, because you're focusing on a very large field of vision, and any little bit of movement is going to ruin it for you. So now we can. You want to move on? We'll go back. Okay, so we were in the storyboards, and now we go into the animation department. And this was really great because we see Ward Kimball, we see Fred Moore, Norm Ferguson, but Ward Kimball in particular animates a Goofy. You know, in How to Ride a Horse, and he basically shows how. Animation works, you know, going back and forth, flipping the pages, or all that. I did spy in the background. I think I saw an early Mad Hatter.
Yeah, with the hat, you could kind of tell it was an idea, I guess, up there.
Yeah, so that was another, like, cool, oh, wow, another movie that we won't see for a decade. is, you know, just kind of, it's there, it's sitting there, you know, ready to go.
Yeah.
And then we go into an animated Goofy cartoon, How to Ride a Horse. I got to be honest, I didn't dig this one that much. This, I felt, was where the movie kind of lulled a little bit.
Yeah, it was very long, and it wasn't as funny as some of the other Goofy, like, how-to stuff. Like, I remember watching the older Goofy ones, and I remember really liking them. And this one, yeah, I don't know if it went on too long or what the deal was, but it kind of was just like,
Yeah, I think it was just maybe a little too long, the section. If it was
that's definitely how I felt. I felt that it went on too long, because, yeah, I love the how-tos. I've always loved them. Even the ones they did... They did some, you know, not too far ago, like, you know, how to set up your your surround system or something.
Yeah, that was
like
the one I was thinking of. And that was a good one.
I really love that one. Yeah. And, you know, there's always the sports ones and whatnot. Yeah. But, yeah, this one didn't really grab me too much. I kind of got a little like, all right, well, that was okay.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, but seeing Ward Kimball actually speak on camera and whatnot, I thought was a really, really cool thing to have. And it's so funny that I know Ward Kimball largely from pictures of him when he's older, but he still has that face.
Yeah.
You know, like, immediately, oh, that's Ward Kimball, I can tell. So I thought that was really, really cool. And then we finally get to our conclusion of the film, in a sense, because we see Walt. You know, we finally make it to a screening room.
Yeah.
And there's Walt, and he looks so young.
Yeah, he really does.
I mean, this is, you know, prime Walt, and in color, all that kind of, you know, stuff. And I thought it was really cool to see that.
Yeah, and he was, like, in there, surrounded by, you know, his animators and everybody, and it was just kind of like, it felt very, like, family.
Yeah, yeah, it's the way I hope it was. You know, obviously, not everything is fantasy, but it was the picturesque of what you wanted, the thing to be. Everyone is doing their thing and creating, and then the boss is in the screening room with, you know, his lead guys, and they're just basically looking at finished products and seeing where they got to touch up on stuff. And we finally, you know, before Benchley gets to pitch The Reluctant Dragon, Walt is ready to play a short. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it is The Reluctant Dragon.
Yeah.
I thought this cartoon was hysterical.
I loved it.
I laughed out loud a number of times. It was kind of like a grander version of Ferdinand the Bull.
Mm-hmm.
If Ferdinand the Bull had someone who was willing to play the part with him.
Yeah.
I thought the voice of the dragon was absolutely fall down hysterical. That's Barnett Parker. He's got over 55 film credits to his name. So he's not new to the medium at all. But I absolutely loved it. Melissa, you really, really liked it also, right?
Yeah, and I can remember this from when I was younger, when they would play like just the animated portion on the Disney Channel from when I was younger. And yeah, I loved it. I love the dragon's voice. I love how he is the reluctant dragon. He doesn't want to fight. And then I love the reveal of, who is it? Sir George?
Sir Giles?
Oh, yeah. Sir Giles. Giles, yeah. Giles. And he's, you know, supposed to be this heroic knight, and he's kind of like a frumpy old man kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's St. George.
St. George,
I believe it's St. George. He, at first, when he popped on, I don't know how they say in the film, but I wrote down it's St. George. I wrote it down as that. He pops on very Man of La Mancha-ish.
Yes.
Is what I thought of. And then he's just as, you know, as not wanting to get into this as the dragon is. And they, you know, trick everybody into thinking that they're having this huge fight where, you know, the guy actually would spear the reluctant dragon. But it's just, you know, being held and that, you know, everyone, yee-haw, and then they all just, like, basically go off into this, you know, their own separate circles. Because then he's accepted at the end, right? The dragon actually like becomes part of the town.
Yeah, he's like in a castle, like telling a story or something.
It's really weird.
I just love his little song that he sings to the upside down king. When him and Sir Giles are talking about poetry he composes the poem to the little upside down king. It's my favorite part.
Do you remember what the words were at all?
Not off the top of my head, but it's like, yeah, it's like, poor little upside down cake, your bottom is on your top. And then he like flips it over.
Yeah.
Like, poor little upside down cake, your top is on your bottom.
You just remembered it.
Maybe.
Ta-da!
Exactly. But yeah,
maybe not exactly. You're very, very close.
But yeah, I just love his delivery and the little, like, motions that he makes. And just to see this huge dragon with a picnic basket on his stomach, I thought was a great juxtaposition.
Yeah, the animation on the dragon itself is really, really cute. I had not really watched this short till I watched this when we were doing this.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just never really came up. Even though I owned the thing, it was one of those like, oh, I'm going to get to it. I'm going to get to it. And I never, ever got to it. And it's really, it's one of my favorite Disney shorts. I would love to just watch this on its own.
I think this, like when I was saying, I remember it from when I was younger. I think Disney Channel did this with Reluctant Dragon, with some of the clips from the Make Mine Music. Because I remember like seeing those little things like the blue cars and the bonnets and like that kind of the shorts. I think they played them on Disney Channel when I was younger. So I definitely remember this one. And I love it. I think even though in the context of the whole movie, maybe it's not something, you know, everybody would watch the whole movie, but the short, 100%.
Actually, you know what? Let me try something out for you guys because I've got a clip of the song. And let's see how well this works out. Actually, I guess volume would help.
This is called to an upside down cake. Sweet little upside down cake, cares and woes, you've got 'em. Poor little upside down cake, your top is on your bottom. The last little upside down cake, your troubles never stop. Because, little upside down cake. Your bottom's on your top.
And there you go. I think that came out pretty good.
Yeah.
I'll find out later. Or you'll never, ever hear this portion of the show, and it will be something that you have no idea ever happened. Or you're listening right now, and I left it in. So there you go. There's your little upside down cake song. And I had to hold myself from actually laughing out loud while listening to it because I was watching it as well. I found a little clip on YouTube. It's a great way to finish the short. It made up for the little lull that I felt the Goofy short put in, which is heartbreaking to say. Bri, what was your whole take on the Reluctant Dragon short?
The short, I really enjoyed it also. I love the dragon. I love the voice of the dragon. Like, same thing as most of the mannerisms. It was a good short overall. Sir Giles, whatever his name is. Yeah. I liked him. I enjoyed it. It was better than I thought it was going to be. I was like, oh, this is, because I think it's about 20 minutes. So I'm like, oh, this might be long.
Yeah, but it didn't feel long at all.
No, that's the thing.
It didn't feel long at all.
It was something I would definitely watch again.
I remember thinking that the boy's voice was also the boy who did Pinocchio.
Yeah, it definitely sounded like him.
Yeah, now you said
but
that, it does sound like...
I looked it up, and it's not. It's another actor called Billy Lee, but I was really like, man, that sounds like Pinocchio so much. And, you know, the timing was right. You know, they may have done it, you know,
just as
a side session, honestly, while recording for Pinocchio. But that was not the case. So, all right, let's go into our question thing, which this is really weird to do for this film because I don't know where these things stand, but the questions are pretty interesting. So let's start with, does this film hold up in a current thing? You know, does this film hold up? Melissa, let's start with you.
As a whole, I mean, I think if you take it as a behind-the-scenes, you know, fantasized kind of look at the workings of the studios, I think it's great in that aspect. I think the Reluctant Dragon animated portion is definitely 100%, you know, you could put it on the Disney Channel now and it would be, you know, received, I think, well by kids. As a whole, though, I'm not sure. I don't know how to answer that.
Well, does it hold up for you?
I mean, I liked watching it. I don't know if I would throw it on again.
Okay. All right. Brian, same question.
For me personally, it's something that I could watch every so often and really enjoy, especially I like I've said before, I like behind-the-scenes stuff. I went to school for history, so I like that time capsule of what this movie gives it, that time and place. For the general audience, definitely not. For like the general Disney fan also, I would think Probably not. It wouldn't hold up for them. They would get bored. If you are really into finding out behind the scenes and that sort of thing, then yeah, I think you would really enjoy it. But something that the majority of people would hold up, and you would show somebody now.
All right, I'm actually going to disagree. I think it does work. I think it works better now than it did then. Well, I think then it wouldn't have worked because people had no idea how to react to it. And now looking at it, it's a time capsule film.
Yeah, it's a perfect term for
which,
it.
Which I think would be fascinating for a lot of people, and especially the fan base. I think that they would latch onto a film like this even more so because they would get a kick out of the same things that we got a kick out of.
Right.
So even though I do believe it has that lull, I do feel that it holds up.
Yeah, actually, back then it wasn't received really well. It was considered a cheater film because it was kind of like it was not a full-length animated film like they were making, so they thought it was, you know, a cheater film. And it cost $600,000, and at the time it only returned $400,000. But yeah, I think you're right. I think if you put it out to fans now, I think that they would take it like a time capsule, and they would, I think, flock to it.
I really do think so. And that's where I stand on this. Firm.
Yeah.
Firm.
If you say so.
Yeah, I know. We'll find out.
To the diehard Disney fans, yes. To the general, more casual Disney fans, no. They wouldn't care. They could care less.
I don't know. I disagree.
I don't.
Very well. Going on to the next question, I don't know if there's an answer for this one. Is this a film that tries to get across an emotional message? Or is it something that tries to get across a morals message? I actually gotta say, I think this is void. It doesn't go for either. Yeah. If it has a message, I mean, if you want to give The Reluctant Dragon, like if you want to go look at the morals for that and you want to look at the morals for Baby Weems, mm-hmm. you can say Baby Weems is embrace the simple, like don't pass up your childhood, maybe in a couple of ways, because the kid like loses his family immediately and gets lost in everything else. And it's only when he becomes dumb.
Well, he becomes not special.
Yeah. Well, or dumb. Like,
he becomes a baby.
No, he becomes an actual baby.
Yeah.
Dumb. Yeah, babies are dumb. Yeah, that's the whole point. So be dumb and like your parents. No. And then Reluctant Dragon was be yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which really, that's what Baby Weems is as well. It's like be yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be what you're supposed to be. So... from that aspect, you can just take that from there. But overall in the film, I don't think it's really striving for anything like that when certain documentaries do. But this is more of a commercial.
This is more like I said earlier, I think off air, this is almost like a propaganda film for Disney.
My God, man.
Well, this was their start of doing propaganda. This is where the government was like, hey, you guys can do this.
Yeah, they were there. Yep. The Furious Face. Yeah. One of the best. Still stands. That one still works.
Yeah, it does.
So, Melissa, do you agree with that sentiment of lack of moral and message, or did you see anything else beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, beyond like the shorts, I really don't think the overall film had like a go for your dreams, maybe? That would be the only thing I could think of.
Seek out Walt.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate message.
Go to the studios.
Seek out Walt. Don't worry about security. Yeah. Just do what you got to do.
Well, they were pretty inept. Like, I couldn't find...
Yeah, he was pretty useless.
He couldn't find Benchley at all.
Yeah. Well, Benchley was smart.
He was.
He was, maybe you could say, a shark.
Oh.
What?
I like when he snuck out behind the storyboard.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
It was when he was leaving I think it was the animator room. With Ward Kimball, I think
it was. Oh, when he hid behind the storyboard as they carried it out. Okay, yeah. All right, now going towards the last question. This is hard. Is there an iconic shot in this film? Guess what? I know what it is.
You know what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. I just played the video clip of it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Kinda, it has to be of the, like the dragon.
I was going to say, what's the cover of the DVD or the poster?
It's the dragon with the cake in his hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
I am too, yeah.
I mean, he's the thing that's come out of the movie the most. I mean, he was in Roger Rabbit, and he's...
Well, so was... what's his name, I believe? I read...
Baby
Weems? Knight. No, The Knight was also.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying, like, from short, like, nothing else really, like, you know.
No.
Except the two main characters, yeah. Guess.
Well, for the two things that came at the very end of the movie.
Yeah, but they've only been in one other thing.
Although Relic of Dragons also in the House of Mouse intro.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did he ever, like, appear outside of that, or?
In the show itself, I think they said he might have been in, an episode.
Crowd because it's basically...
Yeah, they cut to him or something like that. Oh, that's really cool.
But at least it's, like, an updated thing that they're still kind of going back to now.
I wonder how many people got that reference at the time, you know? That's a really cool little hidden thing in there. That's really cool. I like to go back and watch those House of Mouse and just look at the crowd and be like, oh, look, you know, something that as a kid I wouldn't have known.
Well, the House of Mouse is nowadays.
I thought they had one before also when he ran a nightclub. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one.
It was
one
like a nightclub.
Like, he ran a nightclub. Mm-hmm. It was very Animaniacs around that time.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yep. Yeah.
So,
I remember that. Yes. Okay, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. Yep.
So, like, around that time, I'm sure that there was a ton of things I had no idea about.
Yeah.
And they were just sprinkled about. I mean, that was something that was nice about animation around that time is it didn't talk down to kids a lot of time. You know, Hysteria was really, really great in Animaniacs. And House of Mouse and whatnot. And I don't know, I feel
Darkwing Duck. That was like my after school stuff,
It wasn't just screaming.
No,
I feel like a lot of animation now for kids is just characters screaming to get their attention so they don't bother their parents. When if it was just good, that could work too.
Yeah, like the ones that I grew up with, like they had storylines, they had, you know, plot. Now it's kind of like silly plots or superficial plots.
Yeah, it's just, hey, how can we get everyone yelling at the same time? Like, let's do that. So, all right. A weird entry into our Disney Movie Hour segment, right? Will we all agree on that?
Oh, no, definitely.
Yeah, it was interesting, this mashup kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'm glad we did it because I probably would not have watched that at all, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, no, I am too, because, again, I really love the short. I absolutely adored the short.
Yeah.
It shoots immediately up on my favorite Disney animated shorts for the actual Reluctant Dragon short that they show. I think it's great.
Yeah. The shorts during this time, I think, are one of my favorites, you know.
Favorite eras?
Yeah.
Very cool. So what did you guys think? Have you seen The Reluctant Dragon? Did you enjoy The Reluctant Dragon? You know, well, you guys thought I was talking to you.
I thought you were talking to you. I was like, didn't we just know what we just did?
It's like, I just told you.
I'm totally uninterested already. In your opinion, you already gave it. I don't want to hear it again. Shut your face. So who out there has watched The Reluctant Dragon also? You know, do you own it? Do you watch it? Do you like it? Do you like the Goofy short? That's really kind of curious. So let us know. You can tweet us over it at @DizMagicHourPod. Wow, I really wish we could have got the name of the show, but someone else has it. You can also go over to our Disney Facebook group, Disney Magic Hour, and you can leave an opinion over there. And you could email us, you know. Yeah. Could email us.
They comment on the website also.
Yeah, comment on the website. That's a better one. Yeah. Go into the comment section of the page that I make for this one. So we are not going to be here next week because not only is Scott getting married, I'm not going to be around for a number of days from Friday through Monday because I'm filming the sizzle reel to the film that I'm going to be directing next year. This is pretty much the thing that we're going to make to attract investors and give them an idea of the film that we're trying to make. So I'm not going to have time to do the research and whatnot that we want to do for Dumbo, which is going to be our next film. So we will be back in 2 weeks and we will be doing Dumbo.
Grab your Kleenex.
Yeah, that's a crier, that one. Maybe next week, though, we'll have another show to share for you, possibly. I'm not 100% sure. It'll basically just be me guest spotting on another show. It might come out next week. If it does, obviously, we'll share it with you guys. And maybe Brian and Melissa will want to do a show, I don't know, without me, because they could do that totally.
Totally.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, we'll discuss.
We'll discuss it. Do it. I am, you know what, I'm going to probably have to record it with me, but I'll bring it back on Monday. So thanks, guys, for listening. Right now, you are listening to Boo Bass by Pogo. You can find his videos over on youtube.com/Pogo, his music at soundcloud.com/Pogo Mix, and his home web address is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter @DizMagicHourPod. Search that Facebook for Disney Magic Hour and join the group, and then invite your friends and family so we can get that group a growing. And then head on over to iTunes, 5-star review, a sweet comment, and nothing more, nothing less. Say goodnight, Brian.
Goodnight, Brian.
Say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Pete. And say goodnight, Pogo.
Great if it didn't do it again.